For the week of January 5th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 219, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in a bitterly cold New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, I guess, Michael, over the New Year weekend, or the Happy New Year weekend, I don't know what you call it in New York. Here on the left coast, the west coast of the United States, we call it New Year's. I guess you got dumped on.
We did a lot of snow. That's fine, because I don't have to do any sidewalks. I don't have to dig out a car. But it was really cold 2 days ago, and tomorrow it's going to be a high of 14, so it's definitely been cold right here.
Yeah, whereas I was in Sun Valley, Idaho, where I guess normally they have about 150 inches of snow every winter, and this year, since I was there, they had about 10.
Thank you, Al Gore.
Yes, exactly.
I blame Al Gore. And of course, when it's really cold, sometimes you have to wait to bury the bodies. You have to wait till spring in the old days, you know, before they could cut through, and you know, in some very serious climates, and actually bury bodies. So they would have to wait for burials until spring. That's not true for us, of course, in North America anymore. So that means that we will be able to show respect to Saul Zantz and Phil Everly of the Everly Brothers.
I was wondering where you were going with that. And then I realized, wow, what a transition you're making here into our stories. Yes, I don't know what it is lately, but we're beginning each episode with kind of little obituaries, this time for Saul Zantz, who was a producer. Originally, he was a record company executive.
He was the classic record company executive because his artists hated him.
That's right.
Squeezed every penny out of them. He and John Fogerty feuded for years. He bought Fantasy Records and made tons of money with Creedence Clearwater Revival, made smart acquisitions of some great jazz libraries, a very good label. But boy, did he and John Fogerty not get along.
That is absolutely correct. And then he went into movies, and like one of his first movies was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I think it was his third movie, and he went on to win an Academy Award for that, along with Milos Forman, won Best Director, and Best Actor Jack Nicholson. And then that wasn't his last Academy Award. He went on to win an Academy Award for Amadeus, an Academy Award for, why am I blanking on this now?
The English Patient.
Thank you. I could
one for each decade. About the mid-70s, he won for Cuckoo's Nest, the mid-80s for Amadeus, and The English Patient in the mid-90s. He was one of the last great, you know, indie producers. He made his movies happen. He bankrolled them himself. He rolled the dice. He risked his wealth on these movies. And not all of them did great, of course. At Play in the Field of the Lords and other movies didn't do so well. But he managed to survive somehow and scrape together money for the next big film that he had in mind. And he was just a real classic old school movie producer.
And also a real gentleman. The few times I'd spoken with him, he was very, very nice and very smart. He had
just
really
don't sign a record deal with him.
Yeah, well, I did not sign a record deal with him. And he had really good taste. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, he did. He was a literate guy who bought interesting, good books. Like, he backed The Unbearable Lightness of Bean, which I think is a great film. He backed The Mosquito Coast with Peter Weir. So even the films that weren't huge commercial successes were interesting, smart films. And he had good taste in music, too. I'm sure he liked the Everly Brothers. And, of course, Phil Everly died over the weekend as well. That's the younger brother, I think, along with Don Everly from the classic duo.
Yes, they call them the sibling sound.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, neither did I until this weekend.
Well, the cool thing is there were two tribute albums this year to the Everly Brothers. The one that I'm familiar with is by Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day and Norah Jones. And they did a really cool album called Foreverly, in which they recreated one of their classic albums, Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. And it's a really good album, one of the best albums of the year. I'll be getting to that list at the end of January before the Grammy Awards. I'm still listening to music left and right. But they love Phil Everly. I love the Everly Brothers. They were a great band. I saw them briefly when they toured with Simon and Garfunkel. Of course, they were a big influence on them. So it was great to see them appearing in a show with Simon and Garfunkel and doing a little set there. But they will be missed.
Yes, I guess his wife said that he died of, some kind of pulmonary issue. And she made a point of saying that it resulted from a lifetime of cigarette smoking.
Oh, well, there you go. Of course, he was 74, so
yes.
He had a good full life. You know, feuded with his brother, made up with his brother, feuded again, made up again. I think they ended on good terms, so that's nice. And they had some great late career albums like EB84. So goodbye, Phil Everly. And hello to Showbiz Sandbox. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, on today's show, we're going to be really, frankly, we're just going to be throwing a bunch of numbers at you. We'll start with the number 2013.
A year.
Yes, yeah. That's a year, but it's also a number. We're going to follow that up with a bunch of numbers which may or may not represent positive or negative revenue figures. Confused? Stick around, we'll be making much less sense later. Since we're talking numbers, by the way, the beginning of the year, 2014, seems like a good time to provide you with a scorecard of how all the television networks are doing. And speaking of television, the Consumer Electronics Show starts this week in Las Vegas, a place, by the way, where they love numbers, incidentally. It's safe to say we'll all be hearing more about 4K televisions than we ever wanted to. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And of course, we talk about box office around the world, not just North America. And the number one film in the world is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. It grossed $74 million. It's at $756 million worldwide. In North America, it's pacing well behind the other two films in The Hobbit and the other film in The Hobbit and the three films in Lord of the Rings. It's still at about $230 million. It's not devastatingly far behind, but it's still well behind. But overseas, it's doing even better. And overall, it looks like The Hobbit will come close to meeting the $1 billion that the first film in this new trilogy has scored.
Now, do you think that a part of the reason that it's behind is because when it opened, when The Hobbit Desolation of Smaug opened back in December of 2013, way back like a month ago, there was a huge snowstorm on the east coast of the United States. And I guess, it kind of dampened the opening of that film. Do you think that we're still seeing that effect, or by now everything should have caught up?
No, I think it's just that it got, the first Hobbit film was terrible and it grossed $1 billion. But I think people all went to see it and just went, ugh. And so I think they really damped down the expectations and desire to see the second one.
Okay.
This one got better reviews. I think it'll pick up. It doesn't look weird. It's a better movie. It's not a good movie, but it's a better movie. And so I think it'll all even out in the end. Overseas is making up for domestic. And by the time of the third film, they'll be back sort of to normal. And besides, it's going to end up around $850, $900 million, if not more. So I think they'll be all right.
Okay.
At number two around the world is Frozen. This Disney animated film has grossed another $73 million. It's at $640 million worldwide. And this, I think, as we pointed out, is a case of a movie that did much better than it might have because it had no competition. It was literally the only family film available from Thanksgiving until today. There was one other movie that sort of qualified. That's Walking with Dinosaurs. That's a little bit lower on the list. It's done okay, though it cost, overseas made up for its disastrous North American showing. But Frozen just had no other competition. It was the only film, the only option if you wanted to take the kids to a movie. Plus, it appeals to women and teenage girls. It's got strong female characters. It's well-reviewed. This is going to turn out to be one of the most successful Disney animated films of all time. It's going to pass $300 million by the time people hear this. It will probably pass The Lion King and Finding Nemo to be the second highest grossing animated film of all time. Hugh Sperling.
In North America.
And adjusted for? Not adjusted for?
Ink and paint.
No, inflation.
Obviously,
yeah,
inflation.
That's right, yeah. So, in the Disney Pixar world, this is a huge, huge success story.
Well, yeah, and what's really interesting is I think, you pointed out all of these facts and figures. Frankly, I think the real key is it's just a good movie, and kids love it. They're singing to the soundtrack. It's got good songs, and the album is selling well. The soundtrack is just off the charts as well. So I think that as much as there's no competition, it's also there's no competition. And, oh, by the way, it's a really good movie.
Well, I don't like it as much as you, I guess. But, I think it's a decent movie.
Well, yeah. No, I'm saying that it's not a bad movie.
Well, no, it's not a bad movie. The Frozen soundtrack is ranked at number four this week on the Billboard charts. So that's certainly good. And it's rising. But, again, this movie is number one in North America 6-7 weeks after it opened. That's because it has no competition.
Well, and it's beating out films in North America, like newcomers such as Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, and as we'll see here, The Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle and others.
Right. None of which are family films. All right. Number three around the world is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, another $40 million. This is at $114 million worldwide. It's a Ben Stiller film. The word is still out on that as to whether this will break even and how it will do. Not a great start in North America, but it's been chugging along. At number four around the world is Paranormal Actividad, or as I like to call it, Paranormal Dios Mío. This is a Latin spinoff of Paranormal Activity. It's called Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones. It's not considered a direct sequel, but a sort of a shift off to the right, I guess, a little branch off the tree of Paranormal Activity. It did not open as strongly as the last movies have in the franchise proper, but it cost $5 million to make, and it grossed $34 million worldwide. I'm sure they spent money to open it, to market it, but my goodness, that's a great start.
And not a whole heck of a lot of money either to open
this film. Oh, really? Oh, well, there you go. So they're really breaking it in then.
Because frankly, there were very few television ads for it during the holidays. And the only reason I know that it was even being released was, were a few billboards, a few bus stop signage, and all the trailers before holiday films.
Well, you know, I think TV ads during the holidays are lower because there are few people are watching television. They're not watching TV over the Christmas New Year. They might watch certain sporting events and stuff, but TV viewing is typically way down on the holidays. So that might be one reason you saw fewer ads. At number five around the world, a big flop, 47 Ronin. This is the Keanu Reeves film. It grossed $25 million. It's at $83 million worldwide. Very roughly, that means the studio probably got back about $40 million of that. And this is a $175 million movie. It's already flopped in Japan. So this is not very good. It did do well in Russia, where it opened up this weekend, but it's not going to make it to profitability. In fact, the studio already announced that they were writing down the cost of this movie.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the lessons here is do not give $175 million to a filmmaker who has only directed commercials in the past.
It's worked before.
It's worked before, but you know, it's also not a very good practice.
At number six around the world is American Hustle, another $20 million. It passed the $100 million mark worldwide, and it's hoping and ready to capitalize on a lot of end-of-the-season awards. At number seven, another very similar film, The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese's film, that also made $20 million. It's at $80 million worldwide and counting. At number eight is Anchorman 2, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. It is chugging along, $16 million, $144 worldwide. It's doing quite well. And number nine, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire. $16 million it pulled in. It's at $830 million worldwide. It's almost exactly what the original made in North America and still chugging along. And it's doing much better overseas. So this still has a shot at being a $1 billion franchise.
Well, think about it. It's made $400 million in the United States and Canada alone.
That's exactly what the last one made, $408 million. And this one made $407 still. And it's still counting. I mean, it's still on the box office charts here in North America. It grossed, what did it make? It made $7 million last week. That should plummet again because the holidays are over. But it made another $7 million, so it's not quite done here yet.
That's true.
All right. Number 10 is Walking with Dinosaurs. It made $15 million. It's at $83 million worldwide, but it cost quite a bit to make, I think. Wasn't this like a $100 million film or something?
I'm sure it was. I think $80 million was the, at least, the reported budget of that film.
Reported budget. So, and that's what it's made worldwide. It needs to double that. It did disastrously in North America. It's doing a little bit better overseas, but we'll see where it ends up. Now we have two overseas films that have done well in their markets. The Attorney made $10 million. It's at $54 million and counting. And The Physician, also $10 million. That's been out a little more recently. That's grossed $28 million and counting. We've talked about them before. And number 13 is Saving Mr. Banks, the Tom Hanks and Emma Thompson film. That's the movie about the making of Mary Poppins, another $9 million. It's at $66 million worldwide. Tom Hanks was looking for another $100 million magical movie. It doesn't look like this will get there, though it's still got that older audience coming in to see the movie. And it's at, you know, it's gonna do pretty well overall. And number 14 is 4G Theory. I know we talked about this, but I've already forgotten what it's about. It grossed $8 million, and it's at $23 million and counting. Then another edition of the Jackie Chan franchise, Police Story 2013. That made $7 million. It's at $61 million and counting. So that's doing great in the Hong Kong, China territories. Number 16 is Las Vegas. That's still chugging along, $105 million worldwide. Grudge Match, another big flop from the holidays. That's the Stallone De Niro comedy boxing film. That made another $5 million. It's at $24 million and counting. I forgot to look this up. Ivan Tesetrovich and, what was this movie? I forgot. I forget what this movie is. It grossed $5 million. I had to look it up, and now I've forgotten what it is.
It's Ivan Tesetrovich and The Grey Wolf, maybe?
The Grey Wolf? But what's it about? I forget. I know I looked it up.
It held
well in its second weekend because it grossed $5 million probably the weekend before, and it made another $5 million this weekend. So whatever it is and whoever's seen it, they're liking it.
I think it's a Russian film, maybe.
Well, that certainly sounds like it, of course.
Exactly.
Yes. And so, of course, one of the other big flops that's not on the charts in worldwide because it's not gross enough is the Justin Bieber concert film, Believe. you know, that this is, you know, one of the disasters of the year because it's only grossed $5.2 million so far in North America. And that's nowhere near what, of course, the earlier Justin Bieber film made, which was one of the biggest hits of all time in concert films. But this movie, the flop, this disaster, is already ranked number 11 all time. Or it's at number 12 and is about to pass the Stones, who are at number 11 with $5.5 million with their concert film, Shine a Light. So this disastrous movie is about to break into the top 10 of all-time top-grossing concert films.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
No, not at all. That's just saying, look, concert films do not gross a lot of money. So if you got lucky and a Justin Bieber film made $80 million, that's lightning in a bottle. You cannot expect all his concert films to make that extraordinary amount of money. The fact is, this is still showing he's a very popular guy. He's also, as we'll see later, among the top 10 concertors of the world. So, you know, this is not a sign that Justin Bieber has fallen off the face of the earth, that people don't care about him anymore. It's not a flop. It may be a flop financially, depending on how much money they spent to make it, but it's just a concert film. They don't make money.
So you wanted to know what Ivan Tsarevich and the Grey Wolf was about. It's a Russian fairy tale.
Uh-huh.
And it was looks like on IMDb, they have it being made and released in 2011, but I guess maybe it's hitting other markets around the world.
What's on? Well, it's only in one territory right now, I believe.
Okay.
So I assume that was Russia.
I would assume,
but maybe
so
I'm
too.
Wrong. Yeah. Well, so we've got, we talked last week or the week before about this New York Times article that bizarrely talked about Paramount, one of the least successful film studios of the year, praising them to high heaven.
What do you mean, the least successful film studio?
And also saying that, as far as, you know, grosses are concerned, and also saying that Hollywood is in survival mode. So we've got a wave of bad news for Hollywood that proves how much in survival mode they are. For example, box office, it's at a record high, $10.9 billion, which beats the record high from last year of $10.8 billion.
By 1%, so yes.
Yeah, it's more. In China, their box office soared 27% to $3.6 billion, a record high. And guess what? China has three times as many people as North America. So there's no reason that eventually their box office shouldn't be three times as big as ours, just with all things being the same. That would mean they'd have a $30 billion box office. So right now they have a third of our box office. They could triple easily in the next few years, and they still wouldn't catch up to what their population says they have capable, at least if they become movie crazy people just like we are. So China's box office has soared 27%. The sky is the limit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no secret that the international market is pretty much where Hollywood, at least, is seeing a lot of its revenue come from. Most of the movies that were released by Hollywood
there's more people.
Right, exactly.
Of course
it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense, especially now that some of these countries, like we mentioned, China, that were historically underscreened, where they didn't have enough screens for the population, Brazil being another one, India being they had a lot of screens, but they're multiplexing themselves right now. And so you have more ways, more channels for the population to see films, and therefore more people are going to films, and therefore more money is being made in countries outside of North America.
Right. So when you see record box office in North America, you shouldn't expect that every single year. But when you look at the record worldwide box office, you should, in fact, expect that to happen year after year after year for the next 10 or 15 years, because there's so much growth potential. If you look at China's top films, their number one film was a Chinese film, Journey to the West, Conquering the East. That made $205 million. And number two was Iron Man 3 with $125 million. You look, their 10th highest grossing film of the year was Gravity with $72 million. $72 million, that tells you, of a country of a billion people, where their 10th highest grossing film made $72 million. They do have a middle class equivalent to ours of 300, 400 million people. So there's a lot of room for growth. I mean, the number two film only made $125 million. Clearly, there's a lot more to do there.
Yeah, well, and this is kind of slanted because, of course, the government controls the releases and controls how long films get to play. So,
well, it's not slanted. It's a closed market. They only let in a certain number of films. But the fact is that the movie they let in, and however long they let it play, second biggest grossing movie of the year only made $125 million in a market that's technically three times our size. So clearly, there's a lot of room to grow there.
Yeah, years ago, I was listening to some radio report, and they were talking about the highest viewed television show in China, and it was some kind of, you know, nightly soap opera or you know, like a Falcon Crest, but in China. And 600 million people were watching this show. It was like the number one show in China. And I thought, wait, 600 million people? That's two North Americas.
I don't know if they have, that doesn't seem right, because I don't know if there are even enough TV sets to do that, you know, but I'm sure it was a huge number that blew your mind.
Yes, exactly.
Well, and of course, we're talking about worldwide box office, and this year, just like North American box office set records, we got the same thing worldwide. Three studios had their best years ever at the worldwide box office. Oh my God, Hollywood is in survival mode.
Wait a second, if they had their best years ever, here's what I would suggest these studios do almost immediately. They should fire all of the heads of these studios, because if they're the best year ever, how are they ever to... Actually, they did that last year. Never mind. I take it all back.
Warner Brothers was number one with $5 billion worldwide. Disney was number two with $4.7 billion worldwide. Universal was number three with $4 billion worldwide. All record years for them. Fox, $3.4 billion. Sony, $3 billion. Lionsgate, thanks to The Hunger Games, $2.3 billion. And in seventh place, Paramount, the darling of the New York Times, with $2.3 billion. So Warner Brothers grossed twice what Paramount did. Paramount came in seventh, but the New York Times ran a feature before all this stuff came out and said how great Paramount was being run and that it was the new model for Hollywood. The only person at Paramount who deserves a raise is their PR department.
Wow. Okay, well, I would say that Warner Brothers, I think, released something like, I don't know, 20-something films, 19 films, whereas, you know, you had Paramount releasing far fewer films. They may have only released less than 10 films. I don't know what they released.
Well, then you make less money.
You make less money, but you're also taking less risk.
You lay up. Well, yeah, you... What risk? They had a record year, Warner Brothers. You're telling me Warner's was less profitable than Paramount?
Well, I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Well, I'll tell you what I can speak to. That studio stocks ended the year on a high. Survival mode. Hollywood stocks had another strong year in 2013, with many setting new all-time highs on the last day of the trading of the year.
This is a story from a few days ago.
So now tell me something. Why would you talk about Hollywood being survival mode when they have record U.S. box office, record worldwide box office, and record stock prices?
Well, okay, the stock prices, in a way, I don't want to say I discount, but sometimes I raise an eyebrow or two at them, because you look at
Amazon.
That's
fine, but when you look at box office and worldwide and everything else and profitability, it's not like they bought their success by making $800 million movies that only grossed $400 million worldwide. That's not the story of Warner Brothers.
No, not at all.
Right.
And so, what I would say here is, look, you're right. They're doing fine.
Fine.
48% in 2004, so 10 years ago, 48% of their revenue came from DVD sales. Obviously, that's now down to like a quarter of what it used to be.
Because they don't count Blu-ray.
Because they don't. Well, I'm sure that
they don't.
Either way, I would love to see where they're at with their home video sales as well. For theatrical, they're doing fine. The one little thing I would say, let's keep an eye on, I'm not saying it's cause for concern right now, I'm saying let's keep an eye on it, is the overall health of the industry, the long-term health of the industry. And what I mean by that is we want a culture of movie going, right?
Now, Oh my God. People are going to the movies per capita. People are not stopping going to the movies. We've tracked this before. If you look at the population growth and ticket sales, which we have crappy numbers for, by the way, all we really know is that the MPAA says, here's the total box office, here's the average ticket price, we'll divide that into that, and that's what we'll pretend is our number for ticket sales. Even though if I go to Allentown, Pennsylvania and see a movie, I pay $4 at the matinee. If I go here in New York, I pay $12 or $14. So, I mean, the idea that you could use an average ticket price to tell us what ticket sales are like, and kids versus adults versus seniors and matinee versus even, we have really no good idea of ticket sales, but we're just using the only number that we have. But when you chart ticket sales over the decades, along with population growth, you say, no, people are not suddenly going to three times as many movies as they used to go in the 80s. But why has box office tripled? Because of inflation, because ticket prices are larger, and because there are more people. But roughly, very roughly, ticket sales are keeping pace with population growth, meaning people are going to movies about the same as they used to do, even though their opportunity to see movies and spend money movies and access movies is greater than ever before.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think over the last 4 years the population has increased in size?
Oh, my God. You don't look at 2 years or 4 years or 1 year or compare this year. You look at long-term trends, and decade by decade, movie going has remained steady, even though the studios make most of their money in the home. Since 1986, was the first year where studios made more money in home than they did at the box office. In 1986, the box office was $3.7 billion. At the home, they made over $4 billion. That was thanks to VHS sales and rentals and, I guess, Laserdiscs. That was the first year. And every year since then, Hollywood has made more money in the home than they do at the box office. The box office is the driver. It's what brings attention and sales and notice to people. And people go to the movies, but then they buy it and they rent it and they stream it in their home. In 1986, studios made about 15% more in the home than they did, you know, at the box office. In 2012, studios grossed about $10 billion at the box office in North America and $18 billion in the home. They grossed 80% more in the home than they did. That is where the money is. It's at the home. And that's why you don't have good figures on DVD sales and Blu-ray sales and streaming and print and video on demand.
Because they're hiding it.
Because they don't want you to know.
That's right. They're hiding
it. That's right. They've been hiding it for decades. Was there a brief period in which they suddenly had this chance to get people to build a library of movies in their home? Yes. Was that an explosive amount of sales? Did that come back down to earth? Yes, of course it did. Once you've bought a copy of Moby Dick, on hardcover, you don't need to buy it again next year. It's in your library. Once you buy E.T., you don't have to buy it again next year. So that period in which people build a library of movies and TV shows has passed.
Unless, of course, you want it on ultraviolet, in which case you have to actually go and, you know, bring
nobody who owns a copy of a movie on Blu-ray is going to buy a copy in ultraviolet. That's ridiculous.
At least not now. Maybe later.
No, not ever.
Well, no, you don't think so?
In the future, they'll just subscribe to a service where they get access to Netflix to thousands or tens of thousands of movies, and they can just watch what they want, when they want, where they want.
Well,
they're not going to. And people buy digital copies of movies, but I don't think anybody who owns a movie on Blu-ray is going to turn around and buy a digital copy of it. That would be pretty rare.
Well, my point that I started 5 minutes ago is, look, 1.36 billion tickets sold. I almost said people, but tickets sold. I guess that's in North America only. We don't have the global figures yet. Those are coming.
And it's a total BS number.
And correct. All I'm saying is, I'm not saying it's cause for concern. I'm saying, hey, let's keep an eye on that.
Well, because why is it a cause for concern?
Because as you say, Michael, you have to look at the long-term trend. And so what I'm saying is keep an eye on it. Look at the trend. That's all I'm saying.
But what's the trend? The trend is up. Along with population growth, it's basically keeping pace with population.
Well, 1.36 billion tickets sold is the same as last year, okay? And it's the same as it was in 2001, I believe, or 2002. I can't remember which was the...
Well, don't pick a particular year. It's the same as last year. So what? The box office was about the same as last year. Why would ticket sales explode year to year?
Well, because the population is increasing, as you said. It's keeping pace.
Not year to year. Population isn't exploding year to year. 2014 to 2015, it's not going to be that big difference in population. You had about 30 million people over from 2000 to 2010. Not that many people.
All I'm saying is the long-term health of this industry relies on a culture of movie going.
Not movie going, movie watching. Why don't you look more at the total dollar amount spent per capita on movies? What would you rather have? Say the average of movie going was 3.7 movies a year for the average adult. And then it fell to 3.2 movies a year. But they subscribed to Netflix and they bought 4 Blu-rays. What's better for the industry? Would you rather have it grow to 4, you know, movie going habits a year, but no Netflix and no Blu-ray? Or would you rather have the actual going to a movie decline a little bit, but they're spending all this extra money on movies in the home?
Well, I guess that's really been
happening for 30 years. This isn't a new trend. This is almost 30 years now. 28 years, people have spent more money in the home on movies than they did going to the theater. It's great that they go to the theater. It's great that they have that experience, and that's what drives everything else to a degree. But what would you rather have? Someone go to 4 movies a year and not anything else? Or have the movie going slightly drop because guess what? They subscribe to Netflix. They buy Blu-rays.
Right. No, you. I guess ultimately it depends on whose chair you're sitting in. If you're sitting in the studio's chair, obviously it doesn't really matter where people are spending their money. If you're sitting in a movie theater owner's chair, you really do care where they're spending their money because you're not getting
any
money for Netflix. You're right.
You seem paranoid about movies. It's been 100 years now. They have not faded away exactly.
Well, I don't know.
Some of those
early silence are, you know, you can't see them anymore. They have faded away, technically.
So the stocks, as we say, are soaring. CBS soared 67%. Viacom soared 65%. Walt Disney stock soared 53% this year. Comcast soared 38% this year. Sony Corporation soared 55%. Time Warner soared up 45%. Lionsgate went up 93%. And even DreamWorks Animation, thanks to firing their employees and moving their work to China, soared 115%. So that's the stock prices for the year for Hollywood. So if you own stock in them, you're doing all right.
But now if you do own stock in them, be very careful, because I saw a movie over the holidays that made me believe the stock market was just a big racket filled with thieves.
So you're talking about The Wolf of Wall Street, obviously.
Oh, I was talking about American Hustle. What were you talking about?
Ah, but you're talking about Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, that movie is getting a lot of attention. There's some fake controversy, one of them being that a woman said to Scorsese after she saw it at an Oscar screen, "That's a horrible movie." You know, that does not mean Oscar voters are rising up in anger against Martin Scorsese in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. It means one woman at an elevator said, "Oh, I didn't like your movie."
No, but the big thing was that woman in the LA Weekly, she wrote an open letter to Martin Scorsese and to Leonardo DiCaprio saying, you know, my father.
Why can't you make this? No, that's not the same woman. It's a different
person. It's a different woman. Yeah, no, right. It's a completely different woman. That's really where the big controversy comes from. And
there's no controversy. There's no controversy. People are talking about the movie. Let's not pretend it's a controversy.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's not a controversy, because what's there to be? You know, the controversy should have been in the early 2000s when all this came out.
Right, exactly. So but, she's saying you didn't show enough of how evil these people were.
Right.
And the damage that they did to the lives.
And I would have to agree with that.
I don't agree with that. It's not a movie about the damage they did to people's lives.
No, I mean, I can definitely see. I think if there's one flaw to the movie, it's that, first of all, it's way too long. It's 3 hours long. And guess what? I got it after about 2 hours. I didn't need to see one more time Leonardo DiCaprio make this big grand speech. I got what was going on there. But frankly, there's nobody to really like in the film at all. Everybody.
Who do you like in Taxi Driver?
You like the girl.
Really? You like the young prostitute Jodie Foster? She's barely a character. There's lots of movies where there's not people you'd like. That's not what makes a good movie. They can be compelling and interesting and fascinating without being likable. You can make a movie about Hitler. You know, come on.
Well, didn't they do that, actually?
Sure, lots of them.
Yeah. I don't know. I watched this film and just kind of went, wow. You know, I get it. Great acting, great writing, but and fine direction. It's nicely shot, but ultimately, it's as empty as the stocks that Jordan Belfort, the subject of the film, was selling.
Well, that was early in his days when he did penny stocks. He moved on to bigger stocks later. But there is some more controversy. This is real controversy. It's a reporter who did a story on the financial backing for the film. She tracked it to Malaysia and people that she claims are corrupt and have no known source of income, like relatives of the head of Malaysia and their families and friends. And she's saying their money's corrupt. It's dirty. This movie about corruption is backed by corrupt people. And she wants to know where they got. And they're suing her, threatening to sue her. And she's firing back. So we'll have to see what ends up with that. It's a big story in Malaysia. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. But clearly, you look at the guy and one of the people who's the backers and say, where did he make his money? I mean, he's not like he's, you know, working at a deli for a living. So where did he get all these tens of millions of dollars to back this Hollywood movie?
Well, certainly we know where Megan Ellison got her money from. Her father is Larry Ellison, the head of Oracle, the big software firm. And she has come to Hollywood. She's like 28, 29 years old, and she has two films this year that are being buzzed about.
Just a scrappy kid with a dream.
Yes.
And a couple million dollars backing her up. But she has good taste, doesn't she?
She has great taste. Last year, she had Zero Dark Thirty. This year, she's got American Hustle and Her.
That's right. Her, this is the Spike Jonze film, and they were both nominated for Best Picture by the Producers Guild of America, a great indicator of what will be up for Best Picture, and because the Producers Guild is one of the key guilds, they nominated 10 films. Generally, the usual suspects: American Hustle, Blue Jasmine, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, which is certainly hoping for a Best Actor nod for Matthew McConaughey and a Best Supporting Actor nod for Jared Leto. They hope to be a big winner come Oscar nomination time. Then there's Gravity, the Spike Jonze film Her, which is definitely one of my favorites of the year, Nebraska, which I didn't like, Saving Mr. Banks, 12 Years a Slave, and the hated Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, so you like the Wolf of Wall Street.
I liked it okay. It wasn't great. It was better than I expected.
Oh, really?
Okay. I didn't think I was going to like it at all. I mean, I have not really liked a Scorsese film in many years. You know, they're all okay. They're all sort of more interesting on paper. This I like better than his last five or six films, but that's a low bar. Is it one of his best films? Not to me. I don't think it's a great film, but I did like the performances. I got tired of it as well. The downfall took too long. I think it's Goodfellas light, essentially, with a more of a comic spin to it. But I thought DiCaprio was very good. His best performance, I think, for any Scorsese film. And it was okay. It was not as bad as I expected it to be. That's not a very nice compliment. That's quite a backhanded compliment, but that's just how I felt.
Let's face it. It's Martin Scorsese. Those films are better than most other films that are released at times.
Well, it's been a long time since he did Goodfellas in 1990. That's his last great film for me. Maybe Kundun is decent, but that's it. I mean, I haven't liked any of his movies in the last day. I didn't like The Departed. I didn't like, you know, Gangs of New York. I didn't like The Aviator. I didn't like Hugo. I didn't like any of this stuff. I think his heyday, of course, was in the late 70s to the early 90s. It was, you know, obviously Raging Bull, Goodfellas, and a handful of other films. But missing on this list, what's missing? What's missing on this Producer Guild list? What is a early warning sign, as you would say, for the Oscars? People at The Butler have to be worried, as does August Osage County and Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yes, I would agree. I was always surprised that Inside Llewyn Davis took off as much as it did. I enjoyed the film. I thought it was a solid film. And certainly everybody in Cannes loved the film. But that's not necessarily a great claim as to what's going to be around during awards time. I was a little surprised to see Dallas Buyers Club on there as a best picture, certainly for the Producers Guild, that is. Certainly for the acting, yes, I could see that, but that's not what we're talking about here. Nebraska, I was very surprised. The Butler, again, I agree with you. I'm surprised. August Osage County, they have just, I don't know, that film just sank. Nobody's seeing it. Nobody even knows where it's released, when it's released. It just, they did not do a very good job of releasing this film.
No, it's just not a good film. I think you're confusing things. What could they have done differently? Yeah. It's on 5 screens right now. Its per screen average of 28,000 is the second best in the country. It's only behind Lone Survivor, the film about soldiers trying to survive in a military zone. That's by Peter Berg. So, I mean, it's got a great per screen average. It's waiting and hoping and praying for, you know, Oscar attention. That's not coming, but it's got terrible reviews. How are they supposed to release a bad movie and make it good? What should they have done differently? They released at the end of the year, expecting and hoping for critical acclaim and an Oscar hopefulness.
Reshoots. No, just kidding. Really, right. The way to do that is you just do a marketing blitz so that at least that opening weekend you get this huge rush. And
well, it's not an opening weekend movie. It's a movie that older people will like. The jury's not out on it commercially. It will open in January wider. We'll have to see how it does, you know, in a couple weeks. But, you know, it's got a high per screen average. People are clearly sort of paying attention. But I agree, the reviews are bad. People seem indifferent to it in the industry, and understandably so.
And 12 Years a Slave has pretty much disappeared.
No, it hasn't disappeared. It's had a terrific run. It's out of the top 20, of course, because it's been running for 3 months. It's made $38 million, which is a terrific amount of money for that movie. It's a big success story for Fox Searchlight, a big success story for the director. And I think it's very likely that it will get awards attention from the Oscars, and that'll give it a chance to make more money. Maybe they'll re-release it again, or it'll just do really well on DVD, but $38 million for that movie? How is that not a success?
No. I'm not saying that it... I'm saying that right now, people are mentioning this film again and again because of the PGA, because of the Writers Guild, and yet trying to find it in theaters is impossible.
It's played out its run. That's like saying it opened in February, and therefore, what's going on? How come it's still not in theaters? It's already done its run. It's still on 151 screens. I'm pretty sure it's playing in L.A. So get your butt out of the chair and go see the movie. Not that it's that good, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, my goodness. You know, every Scorsese, 12 Years a Slave, good grief. Did you like Gravity? No.
No, I didn't. Gravity was okay. Gravity was okay.
Unbelievable. What movie did you like this year?
I'm playing catch-up, but I really liked Her a lot, the Spike Jonze film.
Oh, I love that film. I think it's one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, I think it's just terrific. It's a great double feature with Lars and the Real Girl, starring Ryan Gosling. And a French-Canadian film that most people wouldn't have heard of, Lawrence Anyways, by Xavier Dolan. He's a filmmaker I've liked for a while. This is his third film. I've interviewed him at Cannes. I interviewed him in Toronto. I think he's really talented. This movie played for like 2 months in New York. It got great reviews from the New York Times and others, but it has fallen off the radar come the end of the year list. It's definitely a critic's film. It's never going to be a commercial success, but a very interesting, well-made movie that shows his growth as a filmmaker. So I was very happy to see that.
Well, and not everybody loved that film in Cannes this year.
Well, Lawrence Anyways played in Cannes?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, well, there you go. Not everybody loves any film.
But what about TV shows?
Well, everybody loves The Big Bang Theory. So it's the midterm of this television season, and we got a ranking, and this is great.
Wait, midterms, did they take a test or something?
That's right. Every week they take a test. It's called ratings. And this year we have a list of all the top films so far in the season.
You mean television shows. You mean television shows, not films.
I said films. I beg your pardon. We have a list of all the top TV shows of the year ranked according to their ratings, which include Live Plus 7. That's data we almost never get to see, frankly. You know, it comes out like 2 weeks, 3 weeks afterwards and it's sort of forgotten. So we're seeing what is the number one show in the country when you include Live Plus 7. That means all the people who watch the show even up to 7 days after it aired on DVR. Now, that does not include people who watch them on Hulu or online streaming or other stuff. That stuff will come down the road. Someday we'll have that information included in the ratings as well. But this is a lot more accurate as far as what people are actually watching. And I was a little surprised. I mean, Sunday Night Football has been the number one show in the country for a while now. But guess what? Nobody DVRs football. You know, you watch it live. You might watch it later that day. But basically by the next day or 2 days later, you know all the people that watched a football game. But sitcoms, people do DVR. So the number one show in the country is not Sunday Night Football. It's The Big Bang Theory with 23 million viewers a week. And this is its seventh season. That's pretty darn great.
That's amazing, actually.
Not football. It's NCIS with 23 million people. Finally, number three is Sunday Night Football with 21.9 million people. And that makes sense.
What's really remarkable is that those people are watching live, so that most of them are not fast-forwarding through the commercials. So that is why you see all of these sponsors wanting to advertise during a live event like a baseball game or Sunday Night Football, because people are forced to watch the commercials. That said, I think a lot of them are in bars and they turn away or order another drink or they get up and go to the bathroom. I don't think they're actually watching.
But there's at least a chance they might see a commercial.
That's right.
That's right. So these are the top shows in North America on television on the major networks. So you won't see The Walking Dead on this list, for example, which annoys the heck out of me. But there you go. These are the number one shows on the big five networks. And it does not include Univision, which is frankly the fourth biggest network. It's the fifth biggest network. It's certainly ahead of the CW, but they're not included here either. So you have ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW. We do not have Univision. We do not have the cable channels. But still, this information we rarely get to see. Here it is, Live Plus 7 information. And there's some really interesting facts here. The Blacklist. These are the biggest game changers. The Blacklist on NBC is up 38% in viewers for its time slot compared to the show that was airing the year before, because it's a new series. In that case, it was Revolution, which has not done well in its new time slot. Sleepy Hollow on Fox is up 158% because that took the slot of The Mob Doctor, which I think was the first show canceled last year.
I believe it was.
A disaster of a show.
Yes.
The Goldbergs on ABC is doing well. The Originals on the CW, that's a spinoff of The Vampire Diaries, that's doing great, you know, for the CW. If you look out at the CW, they have the bottom 10 shows, and they have 14 of the bottom 18.
But don't you find it funny that a spinoff is called The Originals?
That is funny. I never thought about that.
The irony.
So those are the biggest new game changers, The Blacklist, Sleepy Hollow, The Goldbergs, The Originals. Still growing shows that have second or third year. Scandal on ABC grew 50%. And viewers and key demos, according to what it comparing to what it was doing a year ago. Chicago Fire and NBC is up 25%. You know, so that's all great. Now, when you look at this list, you got to keep in mind that you're comparing, you know, to what was airing there the year before if it's a new show. So if you're looking at a show that airs on Friday night, don't get swayed by these big percentage changes once you're looking at, you know, terrible nights of viewing. Friday and Saturday night, nobody's watching. So you can increase your audience by 100%, but it only means you went from 1 million to 2 million. So you've got to always keep in mind, what are they comparing it to? What's the show? What's the night of the week? A big gain on Monday night for NBC on The Blacklist, that's really meaningful. A big gain on a Friday night, that may not mean so much.
That's right. And of course, then you have shows like The X Factor, which you don't really even have to talk about gains.
Yeah, no, not at all. It's lost 20 to 30%. It's down 44% in the key demos on Thursday. It's out of the top 50. This is supposed to be a top 10 show. This was supposed to challenge American Idol, and it's really, you know, just fallen off a cliff this season.
That's not true at all. Look, it's right here. The Voice. Yes, I see it right here. Number 8. It is a top 10 show, The Voice. So, yes it absolutely is a top 10 show.
Yes, The Voice is doing great. The X Factor, however, is doing terrible.
Oh, wait, you mean they're not the same show?
Not even close.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I got them all confused in my head.
One of them discovers talent. The other is just an entertaining show with celebrity guest judges.
Okay. Well, maybe they have one too many of these shows.
Or perhaps four too many. But no, that's not the problem. The problem is just it just did not catch fire. They, you know, you can have two or three shows in the same genre be successful, though it helps if they're not airing at the same time, the same week. When you had the X Factor, I mean, American Idol in this winter, and you had The Voice in the fall or the summer, that was a good, you know, hey, all right, you watch one, you can watch the other. Now that they're all on at the same time, you're right, there's been a burnout factor. You can't have four shows about people losing weight. So, but yeah, the X Factor
has been
the
big... shows about people losing weight and one show about a show where people are trying to gain weight.
That would be a show that I would watch and hate. Everybody would hate the people on that show. Like, oh, I'm eating and eating. I can't get an ounce. Right. So Revolution is the show that The Blacklist replaced. I really was surprised they renewed the Revolution. It didn't make sense to me. It moved to a new night, a new time. It's down 35% in audience and 50% in its key demo. So I don't expect that show will be back next year. But you can look at the full list. It's fascinating. It shows you the ups and downs compared to what they were doing last year. You can see the top 10, the top 20. NBC finally has some signs of life. It's interesting.
Well, you know, one show, I guess it's a show, one event that will certainly garner a lot of viewership is, of course, every year here in the United States and probably even Canada. I think they air this in Canada. The Super Bowl, American football.
They air it around the world. Of course they air it in Canada.
Okay. Well, I think that, I guess, what, last year there was 104 million people watching?
Sure, something like that. And I'm sure more people will watch this year. And, of course, it's available for free now online. You don't have to have cable TV. I have friends who have cut the cord. They do not have network television. They don't have cable. They don't have access to the networks. They just watch things on Hulu and Netflix and stuff. So they wouldn't be able to watch the Super Bowl, but they can watch it online just like they've been able to for the last few years, right?
Yeah, I guess Fox Sports will live stream the Super Bowl for free, as you mentioned. The NFC playoff games, no. They're going to kind of put those behind a pay TV wall. So if you have pay TV or cable or Dish or DirecTV, then certainly you can sign in and log in and kind of validate yourself, and they will provide that to you probably on...
So what's their thinking? Why the one and not the other?
I'm not sure, really. I can't really speak to that. I guess they assume that everybody will watch live. I don't know what the thinking there is. That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can make something up off the top of my head.
Neither can... Well, obviously, we're having trouble doing that right now. So
that's right. Oh, who's the musical guest for the Super Bowl? I forget.
Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars. Oh, he's going to be great, I hope. And he certainly had one of the top tours of the year, didn't he?
That's true, actually. Oh, I see what you're doing there. It's kind of a little nice little segue. That's pretty good. I like the... Oh, I probably shouldn't mention that, right? When you said... Okay. Well, then let's talk about the top tours of the year, 2013. Bon Jovi ruled the day, according to Pollstar, which is the trade publication for the music industry, which tracks all things that are... really tracks the concert industry. The top 20 worldwide tours, they took in $2.4 billion in primary ticket sales here in North America, and that's a $470.6 million, or 24% more than they took in 2012. They only took in $1.96 billion in 2012. I say they only took in $1.96 billion, as if it's not enough. But I guess in 2012, more artists made more money because there were 13 tours that grossed over $100 million compared to 2013, where only six tours hit that mark.
What?
So
no,
basically...
No, 13 tours grossed more than $100 million. I'm looking at the list right now. 13 tours grossed more than $100 million.
Then I misspoke. In 2012, only six tours hit that mark.
All right. Well, all I know is in 2013, from Muse at number 13 to the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, One Direction, Depeche Mode, I'm working my way up, Taylor Swift, Cirque du Soleil, The Michael Jackson Show, Rihanna, Bruce Springsteen, Justin Bieber, Pink, Beyonce, and Bon Jovi all grossed more than $100 million.
Okay, so then, yes, then I misspoke. It was in 2013, 13 tours hit 100 million, as you just said.
All right.
Well, and Bon Jovi hit number one across the globe, and the band's $259.5 million gross was the most it had ever earned on tour in its entire, 30-year career now?
Something like that, early 80s, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess there were a couple newcomers to this list. You had One Direction coming in 10th place, earning $114 million. And then back in 17th place, our Super Bowl halftime show entertainment, Bruno Mars.
Absolutely, with $72 million. But there's a lot of young acts here, which bodes well for the future. Pink was number three with $170 million worldwide. Justin Bieber right behind her with $169 million. Rihanna, Taylor Swift, One Direction, of course. You know, so there's a good number of young acts. So that bodes well for the future.
And hey, I told you we would be throwing a lot of numbers at you today, and maybe none of them will make sense. Maybe all of them make sense. I don't know. Who do you think had the highest ticket price of the year?
I don't know. Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stones. Who
Rolling
were the
Stones,
others?
You got it. Okay. Rolling Stones. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Their ticket price, I think, average was $287.89 in the United States, which, you know, just kind of, that's a lot of money.
I wonder how many shows they did, because they were sort of well down on the list, and there was some controversy about them having really high ticket prices. We were trying to track how well they were selling out. It's kind of hard to do week to week. So I'm wondering if they had a lot of shows with sort of not full sold out, or whether they just had a handful of shows and they sold out, and that's, they just didn't do that many tours.
Well, they didn't perform all over the place, of course.
Right, they didn't do that many concerts, yeah.
Yeah, and frankly, it's January, so we should already begin predicting whether the Rolling Stones will be booked at Coachella, because that's an annual rumor-mongering type thing to do.
At least for you.
Yes, at least for me. Very good, yes. But you know,
well, here's a number that's easy to track. Down.
Yes.
Sales went down.
Wait a second. Does that mean that the music industry is in survival mode?
It does. It does, actually. Digital music sales decreased for the first time ever in 2013. Ever since the iTunes store opened its doors, which was when? I don't even know.
2001, I thought.
2001.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it's maybe the iPod was 2001 and it came around later.
Right. Well, whatever it was, music sales for the first time digitally have fallen. They've always risen every year, even if modestly. So this year, for the first time, digital single sales are down. Digital album sales are down. Overall, sales are down. So they've gone from 1.3 billion units to 1.2 billion units. That's digital singles. And album sales fell to 117 million albums. So that's almost held steady. They sold 117.6 million albums digitally in 2013, compared to 117.7 million albums the year before. But it is very notable because it is the first year digital sales have dropped. When you've increased every single year, the first time you have a drop, even if it's modest, that's certainly well worth pointing out.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was trying to find out when the iTunes store launched. No, that's how much I don't care about music sales. Look, you know, this year...
It opened on April 28th, 2003.
Ooh, very good. I don't know how you did that so fast. That's pretty good.
Wikipedia.
Gosh darn it. I was on Wikipedia, but apparently not on the right section of the iTunes page.
So album sales have down. Digital is where we're selling albums. You can't go to a store anymore. This is concerning, obviously.
It's concerning, but, you know, quite honestly, I own so little music now because I just stream it all on Spotify.
Well, and that's what they say, right? Yeah, they say this is because people aren't buying, they're subscribing.
Right, but now you're going to get $100 from me, or however much it's going to be, $120 from me every single year, year in, year out.
And that's probably more than most people ever spent on album sales, right? I mean, I'm an outlier. I'm a crazy guy. I would spend hundreds of dollars a year, $1,000 a year in my heyday on music. Most people would not buy that many albums. They'd buy a couple albums a year. Even the ardent, you know, shoppers, you know, you're paying $10, $12 an album. That's 10 albums, 15. That's an album a month. That's more than most people would do, right?
Right. I think I would love to know what the average number per capita purchases of music and albums are.
Yes, I'm glad our readers know you don't have access to those numbers right now.
No, I don't. I don't, but I would love to know it, because I agree with you. I don't think, you know, maybe 10, maybe.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. If you count live music and other stuff, I'm sure the number is higher. But, you know, $120 a year from everybody, that'd be great. And yet, the money's all going into the digital subscription services and the major labels and not getting to the artists. We know that for sure.
That's true. But speaking of artists, do you know which artist had the top selling record of the year?
I would have guessed this. I've seen it. I would have assumed the best selling single is Blurred Lines.
Blurred Lines. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Robin Thicke with, and I guess T.I. and Pharrell were on that cut, that track, that I don't know what else, what other slang can I use?
Song?
That song. Okay, that's not really
after
slang.
That, I don't know. I would like to think Wake Me Up was up there, but I don't think it is.
No, it was Thrift Shop, actually. 6.1 million units.
Now we're talking about sales in North America, right?
Yes, that is correct. But now, what album do you think sold the most?
Digitally?
Well, just in general.
Well, that's different.
Oh, okay, well... There were 13 different titles, 13 different albums sold more than a million copies.
That's all?
That's all. That's right.
Yeah, that's just embarrassing. Are you talking about digital album sales or overall album sales, digital and physical combined?
I'm pretty sure I'm talking about the latter.
Wow. So what's the highest selling album of the year?
Taylor Swift's Red, 4.4 million units.
In 2013?
Yes. Actually, I take that back. That was the previous year.
Okay. I thought so. What's the best selling album of 2013?
Hey, it's Justin Timberlake's 2020 Experience.
Okay. What did it sell?
2.4 million units.
Oh my God, that's awful. So that's truly awful. The best selling album of the year only went double platinum. That's it. That's as good as it could do. That's horrific. No album went triple platinum. No album went quadruple platinum. I mean, albums used to sell 5, 6, 10 million copies. That's really low. Now, if he sold a lot of singles as well, if you can add up all his singles, say, hey, look at all, he sold 80 million, you know, digital singles and 2.4 million copies of his album, maybe you can start to see, make up the difference a bit. But that's really notable. You know, people are not buying albums like they used to, clearly.
No, they're not. And when they are, they're buying them digitally. I think we've pretty much established that.
Really? Most of the sales for his album are digital?
I don't know. I'm just, that was my way of transitioning into Ultraviolet.
Oh, well, knock it out there.
Okay, well, what I was trying to say, or trying to transition us into, is that people are moving from the physical media world to the digital media world. And in some cases, now when you buy a Blu-ray or DVD, it comes automatically with an Ultraviolet copy, unless, of course, you're buying a Disney DVD. They have their own little, you know, cloud storage product that they have yet to launch, actually. And if they don't launch it soon, they will miss the boat, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But Ultraviolet, I guess they topped last year with the best week they've ever had. And we made fun of this, or we didn't make fun of it, but we kind of criticized the way they launched Ultraviolet back in, I want to say, 2011.
Okay.
And I guess nobody, it was just a botched launch. But in any case, they had 2.3 million new movies and TV shows. I guess people were added to their libraries over the Christmas week.
Okay.
So that means people were getting DVDs and Blu-rays for Christmas. That's what that means to me, in my opinion. Yeah. And, you know, what's going to happen to those DVDs and Blu-rays? Will they be sold? Probably. But my question is, when they sell them back or they trade them or give them away, they'll now have them on Ultraviolet. You don't use Ultraviolet, do you?
No.
So Ultraviolet, for those who don't know, it's kind of like the movie is stored in the cloud. That's effectively what it is. You buy it once and then it's stored in the cloud.
So if you've got a copy on Blu-ray and you get an Ultraviolet copy as well with it, as opposed to a digital copy you have to download to your hard drive, if you have an internet connection, you can access it anywhere on any device that's authorized.
Correct. Or you can download it and it'll be on your device and only your device. You can't transfer it to another device. So if you're offline on a plane, you can still watch
it. So it's another way of doing digital copies.
Right.
So for a while now, they've been bundling movies. When you buy a family film or a lot of big movies, you usually get a Blu-ray, a DVD, and a digital copy. Ultraviolet is simply another way of handling your digital copy.
That's absolutely good. I think it's a smart way to do it, too. I mean, right?
Well, they've added a lot of studios, so of course there's more availability and more people are using it because it's simply more widespread.
Yes, there are.
I mean, a lot of retailers started offering it as well. You buy it from Best Buy or Target or in Australia from JB Hi-Fi. Canada's Cineplex Theater uses it, so, you know.
And that's kind of interesting, don't you think? A Canadian theater, Cineplex Entertainment, actually sells Ultraviolet copies. That's actually an interesting little tidbit.
Well, that's
there.
Sort of like if you buy a ticket to the movie in advance, you get an Ultraviolet copy when it's available for the home entertainment world.
Yes,
that's the idea, right?
Yes, yeah. That's a super ticket is, you know.
Like they get you to buy it, you know, you haven't even seen the movie yet, but you're so excited for The Hobbit that you buy a digital copy.
Right. In Ireland, as you mentioned, Australia, New Zealand, France, Germany, Austria, and Switzerland are now offering Ultraviolet. And then this year, 2014, you're going to have Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg also.
Luxembourg. I love Luxembourg. I have a friend in Luxembourg.
So, I mean, I like Ultraviolet, if only for one thing. It prevents me from having to really keep track of where a movie is on my hard drive or wherever it happens to be. I kind of like that concept. The whole idea of bringing your former or your past DVD purchases into Ultraviolet, they're charging $2 for this. The reason I found out is because they don't want it's a piracy thing. In other words, I could just claim that I have the film or just borrow a friend's DVD or go to the library and check the DVD out and say, no, this is mine. Give me a Blu-ray copy or an Ultraviolet copy of it as well. They'll charge me $2 for that.
Why would anyone pay $2 to get a digital copy?
I have no idea.
All right.
It's $5 if you want the HD copy. That's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
I mean, just...
But it's more bandwidth, so it takes longer to download, right?
Yeah, and more storage, and yeah. But
that's stupid.
But I mean, most
people...
They're
not storing a copy for every person. They're storing a couple master copies that you all access.
That's right.
Now, all right, so
now,
move on.
Let me ask you this. So if you're not going to do Ultraviolet or participate in Ultraviolet, are you going to participate in a Spotify for movies? In this case, Netflix.
I don't subscribe to Netflix, but I have people who do, so I have access to it.
Well,
I
mean, we were talking about stock prices earlier, and uh-huh. I included this story for one reason. You often take offense, umbrage, you criticize what CEOs are making, that they make, you know, $10, $25, $35 million. Here you have Netflix CEO. He made $2 million in 2013. He's going to make $3 million in 2014. But on
that's not his total package.
Ah,
sure.
No, you're absolutely right, and this is where I was headed. However, he made $5.3 million in profit the day after Christmas in a stock sale. He purchased 15,238 shares of Netflix stock for $417,000.
Less than half a million, and he sold it for $5.8 million later that day.
Right now.
He bought it for less than half a million. He made a $5 million profit in a couple hours.
Yes, which, by the way, unlike some who hold the stock, that means that's not a long-term gain. That's not going to be considered income. That there's a whole tax consequence that
whatever, who cares?
But he also, that was only triggered by the fact that the stock hit a certain price, meaning if it never hit that price, his
they
options
said,
never
they used to
been
say
hit.
Oh my god, we can't pay these CEOs so much money. I'll tell you what, we'll make sure that their salary is linked to performance. So if their stock does well, then they'll do well. So it encourages them not just to make a lot of money, but to sort of make sure the company does well. And that worked for a little while until we started getting all these huge, massive stock options and making so much money with such big stock options that it didn't matter, you know, ultimately long-term how the studio, if you could get it up just a little bit, you could trigger your stock option, make a ton of money, and you didn't care if it was all a house of cards. I don't care how much a CEO makes of a company. I care how much his workers make as well. If he makes, you know, $5 million this year, great. How much more is that than his average? Are his employees making more money this year than last year? Have the people who stuff CDs and envelopes and DVDs and all, are they making a lot more this year? You know, if you got a good company and you got a big, you know, employee base and they're all making more money and they're raising kids and putting them to college and they've got a good pension fund or health benefits, everybody's happy. You know, it's not about nobody should make a lot of money. It's about if a company does well, all the employees should do well, not just the CEO.
Well, I mean, what do you think about Reed Hastings?
I have no idea what his employees make.
Oh, no, but I mean, here, I look at this and I say, well, look,
what
the stock is up.
Their
stock is up 300% this year alone. Now, mind you, there are reasons for that, and who knows? You know,
because they had a disastrous launch of a certain service that drove their stock price way down.
Right, exactly. That said, he Reed Hastings, had to get the company back in shape and raise the stock price. For it was performance based, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, that's the whole point. It's a big company. He's not the guy that should be making all the money. It's a big company. If everybody used to be Ford knew that their employees needed to make enough money to be able to buy the cars they were building.
Right.
Can Reed Hastings, the head of McDonald's may be making a lot of money, but their employees are on food stamps. Walmart's family is making a lot of money, but their employees are handed, you know, forms to fill out for government programs because they know they're not going to pay them enough and they need the government to subsidize their employees so they're not so hungry, they're too weak to work.
Well, maybe that's what this whole
let's get into a labor discussion. All I ever said is, you know, like, oh no, he took a hit from 30 million to 15 million this year. Oh, woe is me. You know, that's crazy talk. That's all.
Well,
but you want to know what the reasonable price is for a head of a company to be making? What do all the employees make? Look at all of them. Look at the guy who's at the bottom of the barrel. See what the vast majority of the employees make, how much they make compared to last year. I think that's a lot more telling than the CEO's salary.
Well, then
guessing that the employees at Netflix are not raking in the dough.
Well, then maybe that's the reason that Netflix has this new pricing tier of $6.99 for a single stream. I guess when you have a $9.99 per month or an $8.99, whatever it is, $8.99, $7.99, I don't know, you can stream multiple streams to two different devices, whether it's the TV or your iPad.
Like your kids want to watch one thing in one room and you're watching something else in another.
Right, because heaven forbid you should actually be with your kids having a conversation and actually spending
time.
So
if you live alone or if you don't want to pay extra for that, you can get a slightly cheaper service. That's
right.
Okay.
Or
why
if you
are we
work
advertising
for Netflix,
their new services?
If you work for Netflix, maybe you need the $6.99 a month.
Right, you can't afford $7.99.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. My problem with this is that it's only for standard definition, so why would you do that?
Why would they? Well, it's, I guess, high def. It costs more to send it, right?
I guess.
It seems like, well, they're just testing it out, right?
People are crazy
about it and flock to it. They say, well, I can save $1 a month. I can't imagine people flocking to that, no. I think it's a big whoop.
Oh, okay. Then it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, boy, did you call this, Michael. A&E fumbled their Duck Dynasty brouhaha in every way. The very conservative, evangelical Christian Phil Robertson thinks gays are sinners and blacks were happy before they got the right to vote. That's right. Not news, no. And not a scandal. But A&E overreacted when a magazine interview with the reality star got some negative press. They immediately suspended the patriarch of the Duck Call Dynasty. Get it? Duck Call Dynasty? See what I did there?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
They immediately suspended him from their key series indefinitely. That made him a right-wing hero, by the way. Fans were up in arms and realizing they were risking a cash cow. The network, A&E, then reversed itself and welcomed him back and promised to run some PSAs promoting tolerance, infuriating gay rights advocates, fans of the show, right-wing politicians, and, of course, damage control experts. Is this flip-flop a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's not going to matter long-term. To be clear, I think his comments are embarrassing, especially about black people. I mean, who's surprised what he thinks about gay people? But, you know, his idiotic comments about black people in the history of blacks' rights in the South before the Civil Rights Movement is kind of embarrassing. So that is a scandal in the sense that, you know, the guy could just be a colorful, eccentric duck call maker, but he's also a bigoted, idiotic one. So, you know, that is a scandal in the scheme of things. It's just not really that much of a shock, nor did A&E handle it well at all.
Well, you know, he said that, you know, he never saw, you know, back in the Civil Rights Movement,
yeah,
he never
so
saw
happy.
African Americans were unhappy. He never saw that. Of course, I never saw any African Americans either. So,
well, no, yes, they did. But let's point out, how different a world we live in now. He says that, and he got a ton of controversy for that. For those comments, it did gain a lot of traction. People did weigh in on it. The network did freak out and react poorly. I'm not saying they shouldn't have done anything, but they did not handle it well because they were panicked. Uh-oh, we don't want to be seen as anti-gay. And in contrast, Robin Roberts, a host of ABC's Good Morning America, came out very casually in a New Year's note, thanking fans who were supporting her as she dealt with her cancer. And as she mentioned, her longtime partner, her wife, her lover, whatever she calls her, and nobody blinked an eye. She's the second Good Morning America figure to do so. Sam Champion, who's leaving the show to become the face of the Weather Channel. He also came out a little bit ago. And that nobody cared. Nobody thought twice about it. So that tells you how far we've come.
And I'm actually working on a post for Celluloid Junkie about the rating system here in the United States, the MPAA, and how they, you know, if there's kind of a homosexual or gay or lesbian.
It's automatically PG-13?
It's automatically R.
R?
Or NC-17. Yeah, there's certain, even just references. It's very, yeah.
Oh,
stay tuned.
All right. Well, we have to make sure you link to it in the show so we can talk about it.
Yeah, it's not done yet, but I'm working on it. But frankly, it's elementary, my dear Michael. 86 years after Sir Arthur Conan Doyle published his last Sherlock Holmes book, the great detective has entered the public domain, at least in the United States. Literary estates hate to see celebrated works enter the public domain, even though they can still continue to profit from authorized editions and spin-offs. So even though Holmes and Watson were technically in the public domain in the United States, Doyle's estate had managed to keep anyone publishing Holmes-inspired works. They made them pay a licensing fee. Pretty remarkable, even though it was in public domain. That has ended after a case we talked about before, finally reaching a judge. Holmes scholar Leslie Klinger had edited a collection of new tales by various writers, but refused the estate's demand to pay a license fee. The judge dismissed the estate's contention and said Holmes was indeed in the public domain. Right now, somewhere out there, Mickey Mouse has gone into hiding. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. The estate is going to, what's it called? Appeal. They're going to appeal the case, so we're not done yet. But it's a big ruling. It's long overdue. And if it has some larger long-term effect on how copyright is dealt with in this country, that would be great, though I'm not holding my breath. The Mickey Mouse reference, of course, is the fact that we keep extending copyright so that Disney can keep Mickey Mouse under control. They're afraid and frightened of Mickey going into the public domain. And literally, the copyright extensions are called like the Mickey Mouse Law or something like that.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse copyright, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Donald Duck, on the other hand, says, once again, I'm second. You know, how come they're never called the Donald Duck copyright laws?
Surely he says, wah, 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 something like that. Yeah. But anyway.
Precisely. Tweety Bird is saying, no, never mind.
Anyway.
Victories in the morning shows are measured by quarters and years because viewer patterns change so slowly. And of course, we're talking about morning television shows. Nonetheless, NBC is thrilled that the Today Show won a weekly ratings battle in the key 25 to 54 demographic. NBC won the week of December 16th, its first win in 6 months. Now NBC can look forward to a big boost from the Olympics and hope this isn't just a blip, but a long-term trend. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I'm going to say a big whoop. I mean, it's getting towards the holidays. Viewing is all up in the air. You know, you got to do it for a long time before you start to chip away. But it's certainly something good to build on. You know, it's certainly better than having a year-long loss to GMA, which is what they've had in overall viewership. So at least it's a little glimmer of hope for NBC, especially with the changes at ABC. So, you know, a lot of turmoil in morning television. They're not done yet. And the Olympics will certainly give NBC a boost.
Broadway always brings in tons of tourists from Thanksgiving through the New Year. You know that, Michael. You give tours and show them all around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Michael, let me ask you this. If you were a publicist, what angle would you take? Broadway has record-breaking grosses or Broadway has record-breaking ticket prices? Because, yes, Broadway shows like Wicked and The Lion King and The Book of Mormon had massive sales over the holidays thanks to adding a performance to their typical 8 shows a week schedule, although they did not increase the pay that they paid everybody. The other trick, raising premium ticket prices.
No, you do get more for each performance. So.
I know. I was hoping you wouldn't mention that.
Okay, sorry.
So they raised premium ticket prices again and again and again and one more time again. Hey, it's not like they can sell more tickets since a Broadway show has a limited number of seats. What are they going to do? Put people in the street? Actually, Wicked, you know, they can do that. They have, I guess they had a recent renovation. They added 119 seats in the back of the rear mezzanine.
That's right.
And those seats are usually hidden behind a partition, but when demand is high, the partition goes away and the seats go on sale. Big deal or big whoop, Michael.
And those have to be awful seats, the rear of the mezzanine. Good Lord. It's a big deal. I mean, they just keep raising the ticket prices. It's always a big time of year for shows. But, you know, the only way they can increase their gross is to increase ticket prices. And that's what they're doing. And it's working. I mean, look at The Lion King. This was the top grossing Broadway show for 2013. The Lion King. Been around for
1997.
Yeah, 1997. That's kind of amazing. Top grossing show. And just because it's so popular, it and Wicked and Book of Mormon sort of trade off. Book of Mormon's in a much smaller house, so it rarely hits the top of the charts. But Lion King and Wicked go back and forth all season long. I think Wicked has a slightly bigger house, but I'm not sure about that. So, you know, that's an amazing accomplishment. Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark was well down on the list. Of course, it officially just closed a day or two ago. That sparked a lot of stories. And one of the stories was about Joe Allen. He has a restaurant here in Broadway, in the Broadway Theater District, and he has a famous wall where he puts up posters of flops. So if a show closes on opening night or whatever, if he thinks it's memorable enough, he'll put it up on the wall and memorialize this big flop. And sometimes people get upset, and then like a week later, like, could you put it up? They want somebody to remember their show some way, so they want to be on the flop wall. And everybody's saying to Joe Allen, hey, Spider-Man's closing. Will it go on the flop wall? Will it go on the flop wall? And he says, absolutely not. It ran for 3 years. It put actors to work. It pumped money into the local economy. In no way, shape, or form is that a flop in my book. So that really shows the attitude of the theater community. And it makes sense. You know, they weren't investing in the show, but it did bring people to the theater district for 3 years. Finally, one little thing I should talk about on Broadway. One of the Broadway PR companies shut down. They announced their closing over the end of the year. One had already launched. A new one had launched earlier this year in 2013. Now two or three more PR companies have launched. You know, like these are publicists who work for one house, like Bone O'Brien Brown, which is the dominant PR firm.
Don't they just call him BBB?
Them, yeah. So they're the big one. And I've seen names from there go off and start another PR firm. So now we've got three or four new PR firms swarming around Broadway, all trying to get accountants and clients and fighting each other. So there's a blood sport, blood battle, battle royale going on among Broadway publicists to try and get a cut of the theater community. One person retired after many, many years, and now three or four have sprung up in their wake, all of them trying to gain a piece of the pie of Broadway.
Wait, where did we see that happen before? Oh, wait, yeah, that's right. Oprah Winfrey retired, and we had Katie Couric and everybody else, Queen Latifah and Anderson Cooper. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, who was just renewed for a second season? I forget. Katie Couric, of course, is officially closed, and somebody else was just announced. Queen Latifah, I think she was already approved, but I forget. Keep going.
Okay, well, in that case, a tempest in a teapot occurred when some people discovered that online bookstores like Amazon and Barnes & Noble also stocked erotica and porn with envelope-pushing themes and sometimes disturbing accounts of incest and the like. The sellers reacted by pulling darn near everything in the erotica category that might raise a red flag, which was everything, removing both incendiary stories of child molestation alongside silly erotica like tales of women bedding down with Bigfoot and alien monsters. It's no surprise that many self-published authors have their books back up for sale without changing a word of their novel. They just slapped a new cover on and new title to avoid raising red flags from automated censors. With literally millions of books coming out from self-published authors, serving as a gatekeeper is almost impossible. Which brings us to the really interesting fact that if you look at just ebook sales, so just digital, no hardback, paperback, the website Digital Book World says the three top publishers are the newly merged Penguin Random House, no surprise there, Hachette, not really a big surprise, and self-published authors. That's right, self-published authors. So if you think of all self-published authors as one big giant publisher, they had more bestsellers than Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, and any other publisher you can name. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
That's a very big deal because you've got Amazon, you've got Kobo. When you talk about ebook sales versus print sales, we don't get any of the self-published author sales included in those figures. So we have no idea really what they're doing. Kobo doesn't release figures. Amazon doesn't release figures. So there's a ton of sales that are not being tracked. And they're just talking about bestsellers. They're not just talking about the fact that there's, you know, 3 million people publishing a book last year. So, of course, a majority of the books are sold are by self-published authors. Of course, because the numbers overwhelm the others. But they're talking about bestsellers, books that actually break onto the charts. And even there, self-published authors are getting traction and breaking through and getting to the top. I mean, ahead of the other big three of the big five. You know, there's five big publishers and a lot of major indies. And self-published authors as a group did better than all of them except two in hitting the bestseller list. So
I would love to
see a very, very notable fact.
I would love to see the figures on this and whether it's like, I don't know, a Stephen King type of author that sells.
No. Self-published author. No. We're talking, I mean, it is possible for an author with a name to have published a self-published book. But when you're looking at, you know, ranking overall, it's mostly people who are self-published authors.
Okay.
They may eventually get a deal with a major publisher and then they won't be self-published anymore. But no, we're talking about genuine people who are not name brands who've gone the self-published route. The vast majority of them are people who broke through that way.
I guess what I'm asking is it some big author, some blockbuster author, if you will, that's selling, I don't know, 50 million copies of their ebook?
No. They're talking about hitting that. They're not talking about total unit sales. They're talking about there have been 137 bestsellers on our charts this year.
Okay. So then
where
that,
did they
that
come
answers
from?
That, yeah,
right,
that,
right. It's not
yeah.
about unit sales. It's about we've had 137 or 254 bestsellers break onto our top 20 digital seller list. Where did they come from? 17 came from Penguin Random House. 15 came from this people. I'm making the numbers up, but you know what I mean. And third was self-published authors. And I would say by and large, they're not name brand authors who've gone solo. You don't see that a lot. It's possible to do, but most people who are already name brand authors stick with the ease and use of a major publisher. And you also see most of the self-published authors who break through sign a deal with a major publisher. They don't want to spend all their time, you know, worrying about print runs and worrying about, and they want to get into stores and have a print copy. They want to worry about copy editing and all the other stuff that they have to do. It's a lot of work.
That's right.
And now, by the way, the talk show that got renewed is, in fact, the Queen Latifah show. It did get renewed for a second season.
Well, now let's stick with books for a second. Bookish, the book recommendation website launched by three major publishers, has been sold to Zola Books. The troubled site, created by Hachette Penguin and Simon & Schuster, limped to its opening after years of delays and multiple changes of the people in charge.
I know how they feel.
Yeah.
As I struggle with bookfilter.com.
The three publishers call it a success, of course, but half the staff will be fired, and the main internet interest of Zola seems to be the bookish algorithm for making recommendations, because heaven knows there aren't enough of those. The price was not disclosed, probably free. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the sense that it's a big flop, that it didn't work and it's collapsed and it was never going to work with the three different publishers and their competing interests. What in God's name Zola thinks the value is of the bookish algorithm, I have no idea, because I get their emails every week. You know, I entered a bunch of books I'd read and they tell me, oh, here's some books you might want to read this week. And they're all this ridiculous, random, stupid, you know, Jane Austen. You might like Jane Austen, you know, whatever. So I don't know what value they saw in it. Maybe they only paid pennies on the dollar. But who knows? A sad end to a noble but quixotic and failed from the start effort.
Well, now that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, really, some of this stuff will affect you. TV everywhere. Let's talk about that really quickly first. We mentioned in the past that Fox, I guess back in 2011, the Fox network said, hey, you're not going to be able to see television shows and television series the next day on Hulu or on our website. You're going to have to wait to see them unless you're a DirecTV subscriber, in which case you can see them the next day. Now,
or you have a DVR and DVR them. We're just talking about accessing them online after it's aired.
That's it. Yeah. Just right. Online. So really, we're talking about Hulu. So if you pay for Hulu Plus, not a problem. You can see it. But if you don't,
or their website.
Starting today, ABC is now following suit. So the Disney-owned ABC. Now, let's keep in mind, Hulu is owned by News Corp, so Fox, and Disney, ABC, and Comcast. Comcast kind of has stayed out of it because that was part of the deal with when they purchased NBC Universal. They really couldn't be an active member of the ownership there. They're kind of a silent partner, if you will. That said, Fox has always taken this stance where they say, look, we want TV everywhere to be the driver of Hulu Plus and viewing on our own website. We want, and TV Everywhere is where you kind of validate yourself. You say, yes, I pay a cable provider or a satellite provider for television. Therefore, they will, they being Fox and Hulu and ABC, will allow you to view a show online.
But that's exactly what they don't do. Because I'm a cable subscriber, but then they say, well, you have to pay an extra fee to Hulu to do it. Or I'm a cable subscriber, and the Yankees tell me I have to pay an extra fee if I want to access TV everywhere. And they still have tons of restrictions on it. So none of them are providing it the way they should.
Right. Well, I've noticed that Time Warner is not a part of any of these things.
Uh-huh. I am a Time Warner subscriber.
And likewise, because that's how I know that
But even here, ABC and Fox, you got to pay for Hulu Plus. It's like, well, wait a second. I'm paying a cable subscription of $130 a month, and now I got to pay an extra fee for the delight and pleasure of watching the TV shows I'm already paying for?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think that if you are a cable subscriber, Hulu Plus should be allowed. What they're saying is, no, you're paying for the convenience of being able to watch it on mobile, being able to stream it to your television and HD.
Right, they
want
to charge me again. Exactly. Right. They're already charging me exorbitant fees. Now they want to charge me more.
That's true. Now, speaking of more, how would you like more resolution?
Oh, I'd love it.
Yes. It's better than saying,
I'm going to lose weight.
Just for the resolution?
That's one of my New Year's resolutions. What were you talking about?
I was talking about video resolution, frankly.
Oh.
You know, just you know.
Don't tell me you want to gain weight.
No, I do not want to gain weight. I am trying to gain pixels. I wouldn't mind a few extra pixels. And
Alrighty.
That is exactly what YouTube and Google are trying to give us. They've announced that they will be streaming, I don't know, their content on YouTube in 4K using the VP9 codec. And this
whatever.
Yeah, now just bear with me here. The VP9 codec is royalty free. It's open source and anybody can use it without paying a royalty back to whoever owns the codec, or the, like, MP3 is a codec. It's a form of a file that streams music.
Okay.
Now, H.265, which is what Netflix and everybody is using, that's a codec. Somebody has to pay for that. So,
okay.
Right.
So they're trying to establish an open source codec, so we support that.
Right. Now, what you're going to hear a lot about over the next week and a half, 2 weeks, is 4K television.
And I don't have a 4K TV.
Right, but you do have an HD TV, right?
Yes.
And you probably bought that, 5 years ago?
A few years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and what the TV...
I'm not upgrading.
Right, and that's exactly what the TV industry wants you to do. They tried to do it with 3D, and everybody said, yeah, we don't care. Because it wasn't big enough. They said, oh, look, there's not enough content, not enough 3D content. They launched all
these
channels. It's
expensive, cumbersome, and annoying, and I don't want to spend 5 hours a day with 3D glasses on my head. I hate it enough 2 hours a month when I go to see a movie.
Right.
And it's not going to work at any price.
And so 4K, on the other hand, is this ultra HD, and it does look good, but there's no content. But that's not really true, because most of the stuff that is shot, at least today, is shot on film, which is 6K, 8K, and then transferred to video through Telecine. So they could get a lot of 4K content very quickly, and Google is kind of giving away this VP9 codec. They tried this before. They tried to have an open video encoding codec before, but they didn't have any hardware support. This time, though, Google does have hardware support. They have, LG, Panasonic, and Sony, and I guess they're going to announce a few other partners who will be building devices that use this codec that can effectively play MP3s. In this case, they will play VP9s or whatever they're going to call this file.
Whatever, it's better looking picture, but I'm still not going to upgrade my TV. Isn't there 8K coming on down the road?
Yeah, I think that 4K may be, yes, I agree that 8K is probably coming down the road, but 4K is definitely going to take off first, especially if you have the YouTubes, the Googles, the Netflixes.
But I mean, a lot
of
YouTube videos are shot by people on their phone. That's not going to be in 4K.
No, that will not be in 4K. However, guess what was shot in 4K? House of Cards on Netflix. So they're going to start streaming in 4K, and this codec is apparently a little bit more efficient at getting this high resolution video to you.
It's not going to make me buy a new TV. I'm glad there's a lot of content out there. If I have to buy a new TV, yes, of course. If I buy one, it will probably have 3D compatibility and it will be 4K. Except in the prices haven't come down enough yet. Sure. The price is reasonable, yeah. But I would not pay up for it. I don't want to be an early adopter. And I'm perfectly happy to wait for 8K because my TV works great and it looks great.
Right, precisely. So there you go.
I don't see it sweeping the world. I'm glad they're trying to support open source, you know, for their various, you know, business reasons. I'm not sure what Google's, dog is in that fight. Maybe you know.
YouTube.
Oh, they own YouTube. I forgot. But why are they? Well.
And they also have to stream this stuff. And it's a much more efficient way to stream using VP9 than, say, H.265. Okay. And that's the reason.
And they'll be better prepared to do 8K when that comes along, right?
I would imagine so.
They would upgrade their open source codec so that we can all get 8K efficiently.
Yes, I'm just going to actually not watch anything. I'm just going to live it all in that way. I'm going to go get the actors and make them recreate everything in front of me. It's going to be as if I were standing right there.
All right. Well, that's how people feel right now. So let's move it on. I think it's time for listener email.
Right. And this week, instead of answering listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, we'd like to thank a number of people. I think we have four here for their 5-star reviews. And actually, these are the only reviews we've gotten. So thank you for reviewing us on iTunes, which
in
is
the last few weeks, not ever.
That's true. Yes, that's true.
Just saying that we've gotten a little flurry of reviews from people in the last few weeks. We appreciate it. We want to thank them personally.
Yes.
And if you review us, by God, we'll thank you as well.
Yeah, even if it's not a 5-star review.
Yeah.
Ergar2, Ergarr2, November 27th. Internet Marine, a 5-star review on November 18th. APT342 or Apartment 3342, a 5-star review on October 18th. And Emelke 1968, a 5-star review on September 16th.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for checking in. It was great to hear your reviews and comments, which were all very flattering. Great to hear.
And that's, of course, on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and, of course, rate and review the show, as I always like to say. The same thing is true in the Microsoft Marketplace or in Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and it really does, as we've mentioned in the past, help us out. I mentioned our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. I should probably also mention our phone number where you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter where our account is @showbizsandbox. So if you just go to Twitter and twitter.com/showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. So just search for Showbiz Sandbox and we should be there. You can find all those links, ways to contact us, ways to subscribe on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, the website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace and on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, you have a website. Every week it's a little different. What is it this week?
It's survivalmode.com, the sequel.
Oh, okay. Well, it's funny because I thought it was Survival Mode last week. But
it's the sequel. It's the sequel.
Okay. Well, survivalmodethesequel.com. Look, if you have trouble finding any of Michael's work on that website, try michaelgiltz.com. Of course, you can always go over to bookfilter.com. For some of my writing and some of my work, feel free to head on over to celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.